Hello, I hope you're well. I'm Laura Sanders and you're listening to the True Travel Podcast. Now, there's a reason I'm speaking more slowly and smoothly at the start of this week's episode. It's to match this dreamy soundtrack, which was written and produced by my guest this week. Cheryl B. Engelhart is a marine biologist turned New Age artist and composer from New York. She holds the unofficial title of being the first person to make an entire album on a cross-country train in America. What started as a cheaper way to travel to the Grammys ended up being a 9-day round trip from New York to LA after the event was cancelled due to the pandemic. Cheryl produced this very track and 11 others for her album, The Passenger, whilst winding through the Rocky Mountains, past enchanting frozen lakes and herds of wild elk streaking through the valleys. During this episode, I find out more about Cheryl's journey and how it inspired the music. I also learn about what goes on at the Grammys, her dodgy gig in Germany, a hairy helicopter ride in Hawaii, and travelling the world with social justice choirs. As always, there's more from my guests on social media, and if you're enjoying this podcast, then please subscribe and leave behind a review. Cheryl, thank you so much for coming on. So I am speaking to the first person to write and compose an album on a cross-country American train, which is quite a unique record to have. So I'm really intrigued to hear your story. But first of all, just welcome on the show. How are you keeping? Where are you calling me from?
Thank you so much for having me. I'm in New York, about an hour and a half north of New York City. And It's beautiful weather, and I'm so excited to be talking to you all the way across the pond.
Brilliant. Oh, New York's such a fabulous city. Are you living in New York City itself?
No, I'm just north of the city. I used to live smack in the center of the city for 12 years, and I do love it. But I married a mountain guide, and he wanted the country, so we sort of compromised. We're close enough that it feels still part of me.
Oh, amazing. So a very adventurous couple, by the sounds of it, then. A mountain guide and somebody who just, you know, composes albums on trains and travels everywhere. It's great.
Apparently, that's a thing I do now. Yeah.
So before we come on to that, just tell me a bit about yourself, you know, your history of travel, how you first got into music and some of your earliest influences.
Yeah, I grew up thinking that I was going to be a marine biologist. I did not have posters on my wall of rock stars or musicians. I went to Cornell University, was majoring in biology, and I was taking a lot of music electives. I had been playing the piano since I was 2. I loved being in choirs and musical theater. And my advisor said, hey, if you take just a couple more classes, you could have a double major in music and biology. And I said, okay, because my type A overachiever personality just, you know, woo, so excited about that. I got started working for the United States Geological Survey doing scuba diving, basically doing water quality research. And the river we were working on froze. And a friend of my mom's, who knew that I also loved writing music, invited me to Rome, Italy, to write some music for a website he was developing. He had a bunch of videos on this site and wanted me to come there and help with the videos and help write music. And that was the first time I realized, I was like, music can take me places that are really cool. And not that, you know, scuba diving in a river wasn't cool, because that was actually also travel based too. But it was the first, it was a real conscious like, oh, this is interesting. I never went back to the river. I went and lived in Manhattan and got a job as an intern and a messenger and sort of got into the advertising industry, where I finally landed a job as a composer specifically for commercials. And that led to putting a band together, using the studios to, you know, practice and perform a little bit. And so I ended up leaving that commercial job to go tour with my band and do this sort of rock star singer-songwriter thing for a little while. And one thing led to another, some opportunities showed up, and I ended up starting to do more film scoring, staying at home, less touring, started working for and writing for social justice choirs. And then that sort of led into other projects, including starting to write for meditation apps, and then really turning my own artistry in from sort of a singer-songwriter persona into this new age artist, where I'm creating more instrumental, experimental music. So that's kind of the nutshell.
That's amazing. So I had no idea that you started out with marine biology, a cool job, and then having another cool job with music. And it's great that it's taken you, you know, around the world into interesting places too. So you touched on that a little bit there, but my next question was going to be, how would you describe your music?
I mean, of course, it depends on who and what I'm writing for. If I get a film score or a commercial in house, then I generally, I tend to get called for the piano, orchestral, poignant, the vocal stacking, you know, sort of lots of using the voice as an instrument itself, whether or not there are lyrics to sing, just like lots of ahs and oohs and harmonies, really tight harmonies. And I've sort of, that's kind of everywhere, whether it's pop music or my new age music, there is a lot of piano driven melodies. There's a lot of vocal stuff, except for this album that I made on the train, because when you're on a train, it's so noisy, you can't record vocals and pianos, obviously. So I kind of went a different direction there. But in general, I think it's a little bit of Enya with an edge, or sort of film score epic, you know, songwriter like Sarah Bareilles. So it depends on what you're listening to at any given point of my musical history.
Brilliant, a woman of many talents. So you mentioned there that you've done stuff for film and even for meditation apps. Any that we would know of?
Insight Timer is one of the bigger meditation apps out there, and I write a lot of music for them. I've done some courses for them on how to use music inside of quieting anxiety. I've done a lot for Simple Habit, which is another meditation app that provides spoken meditations as well as music and tracks to help, you know, fall asleep or deal with anxiety or those sorts of things.
Oh, amazing. So tell me a little bit about some of your travels then. You mentioned that you were invited to Rome, which is really exciting. Where else have you traveled with or without music?
Well, with my band, I've traveled, you know, done tons of cross country all over, up and down the coasts of America. I got invited to perform at a festival in Switzerland, and that led me to meeting a manager that had me come back. So I've toured there with my band, without my band. I've been to Switzerland specifically to perform 7 times, and did a Swiss, Germany, England tour at some point. So with my own music, I've kind of explored a little bit of those areas with some choirs that I worked with, specifically Voices 21C, which is definitely a social justice, really progressive thinking choir. I sing with them and composed for them, and we have toured in France and Israel and Palestine, which was a really incredible experience, and sort of bringing some conversations from both sides together. We've gone to Mexico and did some community building and outreach through music and performances. So that was also a really incredible experience, and totally different than when it's, you know, when I'm in charge and touring with my own music. So yeah, I've kind of bebopped all over the place, which is funny because I've never had the travel bug. I didn't travel a lot growing up. My dad had rheumatoid arthritis and had both hips replaced, which means going through metal detectors is like, you can't. So we just like kind of never went camping. We didn't do a lot of that stuff. I mean, we went to Florida a couple times. it was not something that I had a craving for. I just keep saying yes to opportunities that happen to take me to, you know, living in a monastery in Rome for a month, or crossing the border between Israel and Palestine and seeing what that's all about. So it's not the drive for me, but it's just kind of a byproduct, which has been really interesting.
Yeah, that is really interesting, because most people I speak to on this show have either grown up traveling, or they had that one trip after college or whatever it was that just gave them that bug. But it's interesting with you that it's a byproduct. It's a really cool byproduct, but it's, you know, essentially it's your music which leads you to these places, and some really interesting places by the sounds of it. So you told me about working with social justice choirs there. Just describe a little bit about what those are and what they do.
Yeah, I think they're using music to try to open up conversations and bring awareness to specific issues. For example, working with Voices 21C, they each year we have a program, and the program has a theme. Like, it might be forced migration, or it might be race, or it might be women's empowerment and sort of the suppression of females throughout history. And inside of those programs, they'll choose music. The artistic director and the people involved with choosing what we sing that year will pick pieces that will either have been controversial or have some sort of weight to them. For example, for the women's suffrage and the femininity program, that was going to be performed in France. And so I found this poem from an 18th century female poet who was a fighter in France, and she actually like fought in wars, and I think she ended up getting persecuted because she wasn't supposed to be as a woman, but she wrote this beautiful poem And when it's translated, it says, "Put down your sword, we have not come for yours." And it's really like a plea for the men to stop being so scared of and defensive in the presence of women. So I brought the French in. It's called Triomphe Féminin, and it's, you know, the triumph of women. And it's not the triumph of women over men. It's just taking up half the sky. Half the Sky is actually a book written on the, like, the whole topic. And so that was kind of the theme. So anyway, so it's work like that where we can kind of make some points and have it be delivered in a different way than like someone just telling you or putting it in a headline on a newspaper. It's just a little more, it's almost like a softer way to say, hey, what if you thought about it this way?
That's really interesting. And in some of these places, such as, you know, Mexico, for instance, how were the messages you were singing about being perceived? Were you ever in any danger? How did people react to them?
Yeah, no, in Mexico, Mexico is really a beautiful place. We actually had started a program around race and forced migration. And so that the forced migration part really spoke to the Mexican people, obviously. In that setting, the piece that I wrote and premiered for that particular program was called The Listening. And it's really about listening to the oppressed voices, but it was based on and inspired by a speech by Martin Luther King, a very lesser known speech. And we ended up recording it during the pandemic and had Martin Luther King's goddaughter singing the solo, Donsley Abernathy. So that turned into a whole other sort of message. But it was really like, if we can listen to the voices of the oppressed, whether they are being, you know, forced to migrate somewhere, whether they are refugees, whether they are, you know, Black people, whatever the oppressed population is, if we listen, that we don't need to necessarily be the loudest voice in the room. We just need to kind of be there for humanity in general. So that was received really, really well. I think we had the most sort of conflict when we were in Israel-Palestine. It was hard to know who was in our audiences. And so singing pieces about, there's a piece that we sing called Would You Harbor Me? And harbor meaning like, who would you let in your home? And, you know, we sort of share facts about the piece and what harbor means, because there wasn't a Hebrew translation for the word harbor. So we sort of had some people share, okay, like when these people were displaced, and we thought we were in sort of a liberal audience, and it turned out that the audience was not. And so, you know, people sort of stood up and yelled and things like that. So that was the only time we actually had an incident where we're like, oh, this is not landing well for them. This goes against what they've been taught and their beliefs. But most of the time it's received well and it sort of pushes boundaries and might make people uncomfortable, but they know that that uncomfort is where the learning needs to happen.
Yeah, really, really interesting. And glad to hear, you know, you weren't in any severe danger or anything, that was the most that it was, you know, with the protesting about it. But so interesting. And the people in the choirs, are they people who just want to spread the message, or have they experienced whatever you're talking about themselves?
I think it's a mix of people. I think, you know, people find the choir and they're wondering, is this a normal choir or is this sort of a more artistic experimental choir? My experience, the only one I've been in is Voices 21C, although I have written for others that are just trying to choose music that is not just the typical same, you know, written by dead white men. Like, from, you know, there's a lot of choirs like, hey, what else is out there?
Yeah, definitely. That's really cool. So moving on to your album then, and creating this entire album on a cross-country train in the US, did you set out knowing you wanted to do this, or did it sort of start to happen on the train? Just tell us a little bit about it. I mean, first of all, what's the name of the album?
It's called The Passenger, and it's my seventh album, and I had just released an album last year and it did really well. It was number one on iTunes and Amazon and all these places, and it did so great. And I was like, okay, great, we're gonna take a break. It's gonna, like, yay, a year off, not gonna do another album cycle. And in December of 2021, I was looking to purchase a flight from New York to Los Angeles to go to the Grammys, and they were so expensive. And I kind of off the cuff joked to my husband, I was like, I'm just going to take a train. And I just love trains. It's one of the few modes of transportation where I don't get carsick, airsick, seasick. Like, I know, marine biologist getting seasick, it's stupid, but I do. So I booked a train ride out, and it was 5 days. I wanted to go through the Rocky Mountains. There's several different ways to get to Los Angeles from New York, but I wanted to take the most scenic route. And then I was going to go to the Grammys, and then I was going to fly home. And the trip was supposed to leave January 22nd. But early January, they canceled the Grammys because of the COVID peak. And that same week they canceled the Grammys, one of my best friends passed away from cancer. And I was like, do I still go on this trip leaving in 12 days? Like, what? And something just told me, like, get out of this room, get out of the house, get out of your skin, and just go. And so I did, and I was so exhausted just emotionally, and I was like, traveling always takes so much energy for me. Like, there's so much logistics and planning, but there was something so magical just about being able to, like, lie down and look out this huge window and be so still, but also be moving at 80 miles an hour across the country. Like, it was travel that I had never really consciously thought could provide that rest without feeling like I needed a vacation after the vacation. You know, people say that. And so I went, and about 2 days in, I realized I had this idea after I booked the ticket. I was like, maybe I can make an album on the train, and another one of those just like, what if? And then I decided, I was like, let's just try it. I do really well with a good time limit, a deadline. And I like small spaces, you know, as I create. So about 2 days in, I had already had 3 or 4 tracks written. I knew I could make an album, which was 7 tracks. I actually ended up writing 12 on the 5 days out. And it just came really easily. There's a lot of creative stuff that was happening. But 2 days in, I knew I had enough time to finish it in 5 days, but I also felt like I needed more time on the train. So I canceled my flight home from the train. Like, we had 5 minutes at stations, which is the only time I really had reception, like calling Amtrak, calling Delta, canceled my flight and booked another train trip back, a different route back. So it ended up being 9 days total. After I got to LA, I stayed for 2 days with my sister and then came back.
Wow, that's fantastic. First of all, I'm so sorry to hear about your friend. That must have been really heavy. You know, it's heavy at the best of times, isn't it? During the pandemic as well. But it sounds as though being on that train and just being creative and just being by yourself was almost part of the healing process for you. Do you feel that way? Do you feel that that had some impact on the outcome and the songs that you created?
Absolutely. I don't necessarily think it's an album for grieving. It's not super depressing. There are a couple songs that are a little more somber. I would wake up and the moon would be shining right into my window, and I would wake up and I had dreams. Like, Kevin was in every single one of my dreams. And I had this little moonlight that I brought with me because I didn't know. I had a couple, like, throw pillows, and, you know, I really wanted to make the space my own. And I had this little moon globe with me, and several times it would just, like, start lighting and going on like a strobe light. And I'd never seen it do that before. And everyone that knows him called him a light. Like, he was that person that lit up a room and everyone in it anytime he entered. So there's a lot of light stuff for me going on that just made me feel like he was kind of with me on the ride. And so when I would wake up, I would, you know, from very spotty sleep because you've got the train stopping and starting in a hot, like the choo-choo, you know, like it's literally like all night long. So, you know, the sleep was what it was, but I would wake up in the morning. I would just first thing open my computer and see what would come out. And I can tell now, listening back, which pieces on the album were the ones that were those early morning pieces versus the ones that are a little more hopeful and a little more meditative and less kind of like there's this lingering feeling on a couple of them, the longing. But I think that they make up the album. They're not the whole album. I don't think it's a depressing album at all. But I do think there is some music for processing emotions, whether it's grief or something else. That was sort of my intention, was like, if I'm going through big emotions, if I'm going through this experience of being on this very unique journey, my hope is that that translates somehow to the music so someone else can experience whatever they need to process and have their own experience, even if it's very different from mine. So I think it, to answer your question, yes, it definitely is reflected in the music. And it was also a huge healing process for me, and a really nice space to be able to feel really big emotions without any judgment.
Absolutely. Well, I'm glad to hear that. And that's the beauty of music, isn't it? Is that it can be interpreted in so many ways. I mean, you would intend it to mean one thing, or it would have been inspired by one thing, and it can mean something to somebody else. But the interesting thing is that you were, you know, winding your way through all these incredible landscapes, I mean, the Rocky Mountains and all of those, and writing your music. And, you know, just tell me a little bit about how much the landscape influenced the sounds and the music.
Yeah, so much. I brought this little microphone with me with the intention of possibly recording some of the sounds from the train so that it could literally not just influence it, but actually sonically be a part of it. And I realized very soon that, like, most of the cool sounds I like, it was just noise. And I was like, no one needs to hear this. I really thought that it was just a noisy experience, like the train sound, everything. There's this rumbling, you know. So I actually never used my microphone. But I do think that there is landscape in the music for sure. I literally cried, not because I was grieving, when I saw, you know, we were going through the Rocky Mountains. And on my left, there's beautiful mountains and the Colorado River. It was frozen, completely frozen. And I looked over and there were about 100 elk running across the river through the snow. And I can't believe I caught it on video. I'm just finishing up the making of the video. And I'm so excited to be able to share that moment. But I threw my computer down, took my headphones off, and I was just like, this is what the word breathtaking means. Because I out loud was like, that is the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. And there were several moments like that when you go from the mountains and then an hour later, there's palm trees as you're entering California, like snow to palm. I was just like, this is so crazy. It's like, it's really, really cool. And so there's joy and that hope and just this feeling of being small without feeling insignificant. Like I felt like I was part of that scenery and I was not alone, even though I was sort of in solitude. So I think that I hope that translates to some of the pieces as well. But I absolutely let it was really the landscape and the big emotions. Those were the two driving factors of inspiration on this trip.
I really want to go on that train trip now. It sounds absolutely magical. So just moving on to that, then let's talk about a couple of the tracks specifically. So The Beautiful Bridge, that's the first album on the track, if I'm correct.
It's the first track on the album. Yes.
First track on the album. What did I say? First album. My brain's not working today.
No, I totally get it. I love it. I speak backwards. And I also love that, like, we call songs tracks on albums as well, but then there's all the train tracks. And there's so many, like, words that cross over.
Oh, yeah. See, there you go. Double meaning again. Anyway, so The Beautiful Bridge. Was there a beautiful bridge in particular that track is named after?
There was not. No. The piece... All of these pieces were not named while I was on the train. Actually, the temporary names were when I wrote them. So it would be Monday sunrise, Tuesday lunch, dinner sunset, or Saturday sunset sort of things. Because I didn't know what the names were going to be, especially when it's easier when you have songs that have lyrics and you're singing like, I love you with all my heart. Cool, we're going to call the song I Love You With All My Heart when that's the lyric you sing over and over again. But I really wanted to see kind of what came out of these pieces. And that piece was one that I sent to a friend of mine, Lily Hayden, who has won the Grammy for New Age music. She's an amazing violinist. She actually was nominated this year as well. So two nominations, one win, and a vocalist and a composer. And she called me after she had seen my post about Kevin passing away. And she was... You know, it was just a beautiful condolences call. And she said that she, you know, she experienced that loss with her mother and they were really close. But now we have this beautiful bridge to the spiritual world. When you don't have someone that you've lost, you don't have that bridge to the spiritual world. And I just thought it was such a really cool concept of now we're connected to a whole other realm because of the loss, which is, but we gained this bridge. And so she literally said the words, the beautiful bridge, on the phone to me. And that I've been writing down phrases, you know, since I had the idea of just to see like what would land. And then when I sent her this track, and it really has three sections, this beginning and then this very strange departure and then the end, which is similar to the beginning. So it's like ABA kind of form. And I was like, oh, musically, it's like there's a bridge connecting these two sort of stable things. And I just thought that was a perfect phrase for that. And no, I didn't actually have... I mean, I went over a bunch of bridges, but none of them inspired that title. It actually came from a conversation a week earlier.
That's really interesting. Because I expect you to say, yes, it was named after this bridge and that track means that. But it's almost got a deeper meaning from them being named after phrases or other things that were going on in your life. So yeah, really cool. Yeah. Now... With your album, not track, for your album, is there a specific order it needs to be listened to? And is there like a journey or does it not matter? I know with some artists, it's like, yes, it's a journey. You need to start.
Yeah.
But others are like, no.
Yeah. It's funny because I've, you know, this is my seventh album and some of the albums are, you can listen to them, whatever. The last one I did, A Seeker's Slumber, it really is like the journey of a day of waking up, having some conflict, resolving conflict, remembering, and then trying to fall asleep. You know, it's really designed to help you get through the day so that you can have good slumber at that night. And I love it when people say they listen to it in order and they really can feel that progression and that finding peace. This album, I think, there is an order. It does start a little slower, more somber, and I think it's sort of finding the hope. But I am not sad if people listen to it out of order. But there is an order, and it sort of ends with this like very loving melodies. It's called The Ambient Love is the last track on the whole album. And The Ambient Love has a couple little themes from other songs, like little notes. So it kind of sort of wraps up the whole experience for me. But I'm not attached to that order at all. it was intentional, but it's not one of those like journey albums, ironically, because it was all a journey. But, you know.
Yeah, it's interesting. So I have to ask you about the Grammys. You've just been to the Grammys, haven't you? Just before a couple of weeks ago. Wow.
Yeah.
What's it like? What's it like to be there?
This was my third time going, attending. So I'm a Recording Academy member. It doesn't mean I was nominated, although I hope I will be with this album in the New Age category. So fingers crossed, but I am a voting member, which means I can attend. And they're just huge events. You are kind of shuffled around from there's a premiere ceremony where that's where they do like 90% of the awards. You don't see on TV. If you watch the Grammys, like on TV, you're only seeing a very small portion of all of the awards. So the premiere ceremony is in a different venue. And so once that's over, thousands of people are sort of shuffled, I imagine, like a cattle run into this huge arena, which is where the actual Grammys take place. There's lots of parties before, the night before, the night after, different live music performances, small and large. This year, I actually performed at one of those, not Grammy sponsored, but a Grammy event party with the Dallas String Quartet, and we were able to perform a few songs off of this album and a single classical single that we're going to be releasing later this year. And it's just a really cool, like, everyone there knows that you're there because you either want a Grammy, have a Grammy, or admire the music that's made in the container of the Recording Academy. Like, there's a certain standard, which is how I've wanted a Grammy for 17 years. It's just sort of been a thing, like almost like a joke now. People, you ask anyone on my email list, on my fan list, like, what does Cheryl want? And people be like, a Grammy, duh. But it's for me, it's just a standard. Am I creating something that could be eligible, could be of the quality of, and it's like a benchmark for me. It's not an end game. It's definitely just a milestone along the way.
That's really exciting. So there you go. I didn't know that there's a whole other thing happening as well as the little bit we see on TV. So that's really cool.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah,
you say you are, you're able to take part in the vote.
Yep. Yeah. The Recording Academy is what puts on the Grammys. And the Grammys is not chosen by just a couple people. It's the entire membership. And I think there's 11 or 12,000 members that are voting members that can... There's two rounds of voting. You can submit your album if it's eligible, meaning it was released in a certain time. It has a certain number of minutes of music on it. So I've had four albums that were eligible and were on the first round of the ballot, essentially. And you can vote for a certain number of, I think you get 10 votes in 10 different categories. They don't want everyone voting in everything. They want people to sort of stay in their lane in terms of what are you an expert in. You should be voting in that category. So I don't vote in, the metal rock category because I'm not a metal artist or whatever. So you vote and then you find out from there who the top five in each category were. And that's how you find out who was nominated for a Grammy. And then in the second round, we vote out of those five, we vote for the one, again, in the categories that we're the expertise in. So, you vote in wherever you feel like you could make the biggest difference. And, like, obviously I vote in New Age and classical and those sorts of things versus, like I said, like death metal. I don't think there's a death metal Grammy, but still. jazz, I am not a jazz cat. So I leave the jazz up to the real jazz people. Yeah, and then we vote, the Voting Academy members vote on the final round. And then when you're actually watching the Grammys, that's when they announce the winners from that vote casting.
That's really cool. So how does one become a member? Do you have to pass a certain test, meet a certain criteria? Or
When I became a member, you had to have a certain number of credits on different albums. Like you did have to have, there was criteria for that. you've worked on things that have been released publicly, like you're not just writing, you know, writing songs in your garage. Since then, it's changed that you need two recommendations from current members, and they have to fill out some forms and write some essays and things, and then you have to also basically prove and say, this is why I would be a good member of the Recording Academy, and this is you know, I'm a professional musician full-time, like this is kind of the thing. So I don't know exactly what the standards are now, because it is different than when I got in, but I have given some people recommendations, so I know what that end looks like. But yeah, you there is an application process, and then there's like a yearly fee, which is not crazy. I think it's like $100 a year to be a member, and they have a lot of outreach and networking events and things like that. So it's, to me, it's worth it.
There we go. An insight into the Grammys. That's been a lesson for me. That's really, really interesting. Really cool. So moving back onto travel a bit now then, tell me about some of your other adventures. You say you've traveled, you know, around the country a lot with your band, as well as this big adventure you've been on with your album. So what have been some of your most memorable journeys and why?
Oof, a couple. I mean, my husband, being a mountain guide, goes, before the pandemic, was living in Chamonix, France, for the summers, guiding on Mont Blanc, and there. And I've spent a couple months there with him, and I just feel like it's such a beautiful, charming area. It's amazing. I mean, people like riding their bikes with like baguettes. I literally, every morning I would wake up singing the beginning of Beauty and the Beast, like little town full of little people. Like, why would you not sing that song every day? Like, people have books and like, I don't know. It's just so charming. I'd love that. So yeah, not super adventurous, but I did love my time there. I think the one of the more crazy adventures was when I was touring. I was doing a solo tour. So it was just me and a big piano keyboard that I was toting around all over Germany and Switzerland. And I took a train to get to Hamburg, and I was there, and the venue I was playing said, yes, we'll pay you, and we also have, we'll provide you accommodations. So I get there, and it's like this hole in the wall bar, like, and I was like, all right, well, whatever, they're paying me and they're putting me up for the night, that's fine, then I'll be on my merry way. And I said, okay, like, where, I was early, of course, because I'm always early. And I was like, where's the accommodations? And they're like, follow me. And it's literally in the same building as the bar. You go through the men's room and you go down a tiny little hallway and then open up to this tiny little room with a single bed that was, had a black bedspread on it with a skull and crossbones on it and bars on the window, which I found out is good reason, because there's the alley for the bar was on the other side, so you hear all the people sick after the night out. It was
no
dreadful. And I was supposed to be there two nights because I had another gig the next night, and they said, yeah, you can just stay here for two nights. And luckily I was part of a songwriters network, and so I went to the Facebook group and I said, does anyone know anyone that lives in Hamburg, Germany that would be willing to put me up for one night, because I don't know if I would like to stay here another night. Like, this is not good for a single woman. There are so many reasons why it was not good. Like, the skull and crossbones was the least of my worries. And luckily I actually got connected to someone whose family was away. She had basically a mansion in Hamburg and had all these rooms free, and we became friends, and it was like a lovely little, you know, side benefit. So that was a fun travel experience.
Yeah. Are you sure you're not a little bit death metal among skull and crossbones?
Maybe I am. maybe I've sent out those vibes and they're like, this sounds like the perfect place to put our little girl from New York. Like, that's just somewhere someone thought that was a good idea. So maybe I am putting out the death metal vibes.
And what kind of music or what kind of songs were you playing at that bar?
That was like my pop stuff, like, you know, as if you were Sheryl Crow or Alanis Morissette or Sarah Bareilles. Those are the three comparisons I get a lot. And, you know, solo, it's even less rocky. Like, sometimes when I have a drummer and the guitars and bass and my band with me, like, yeah, we can rock out a little bit. I could like put some goth eyeliner on. But like that solo, it was just, they knew I was performing solo, where it's a little more mellow. It's definitely more like girly pop than when you got a nice drum beat behind you. So the whole thing didn't make any sense to me, but
well, it was a story to tell anyway. And yep, it sounds like it all worked out. You got to go and stay in the mansion. Yeah. And it all worked out. You made a friend as well, which is great. But yeah, mm-hmm, interesting story. But you know what? They're awful at the time, aren't they? Some of these stories. I mean, I can relate with some of the places I stayed in as a student. Awful at the time, but you know, fun story. And Chamonix, oh, what a beautiful place. I've been there skiing a couple of years. And did you go to the top? Because you can take the cable car up to the top, can't you?
Yeah, the Aiguille de Midi.
That's it.
It's a cable car that goes up 12,000 feet and you end up on the top on a glacier. And it's beautiful. It definitely feels like the highest point on the earth that I've ever been. But I would go up with my husband and his clients, and they would go out, they would walk out. You could walk out on the
They're the crazy people that
they're the crazy people that you see that go out, and that's him. And he, and then they either go ice climbing on some of the other peaks around there, or they will ski down, and or go over to the Mont Blanc side and ski down Mont Blanc, which apparently is like not a crazy hard ski. It's very long. And it's like a blue if you do skiing. So yeah, so I have some really fabulous pictures of him going out and being that crazy guy. Like, who are those crazy people? Yes.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. I can now say I know one of those crazy people. Mm-hmm. Know who one of those crazy people was.
You know, the crazy person that married that crazy person.
Yeah. I've been up there myself, and you know, I'm struggling with the thin air, let alone thinking climbing or skiing anything, and I'm like, who are these maniacs there with ice picks and, you know, skiing? Literally, for people who haven't been, it's literally like you are standing on the edge of a pin at the top. It's so steep, and then to ski down from that, you know, it's not a proper run, it's proper off piste. Like, wow, hats off to him. Sounds like your husband has taken you to some interesting places as well.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sort of the city girl, right, with the big music venues and the festivals, and so I drag us around to cities, and he's like, hey, I'm spending the summer in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, or the Tetons, or, you know, he's from Maine, northern Maine, so we'll go to North Conway or New Hampshire, and I'm not a climber or skier. I have gone, and I can hang in terms of conversing, like I know enough of it. We joke that he used to play trumpet in high school, and I used to rock climbing gyms. So we joke that we each know about like 10% of what the other person does, which is just enough to like be able to hang out in a conversation, but enough to like say, okay, you go do your thing.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes some adventures are just the ones that are, it's funny because my husband and I defined adventure to be when you don't know what the outcome is going to be.
That's really interesting.
We had a great conversation about how his job as a climbing guide, he's one of very few people in America that can guide anyone in the world internationally. He's internationally certified and teaches other guides. And he was talking about how his job is risk management. It's about knowing how it's going to go. Like every day when he does his job right, like people are not in danger. He knows when to turn around because of weather. He knows what knots to tie in the ropes and things and how to keep his client. He knows what his client's abilities are. And he's like, you know, I have a life that looks adventurous, but it's when I'm doing it right, it's not. I know how it's going to go. We're coming down. And so for me, it's like, he's like, you're more adventurous sometimes when you look at your, like my studio, I'm renovating my studio downstairs. Right? And I couldn't find a company to put in hardwood floor. We had this ugly old carpet. And I was like, we need to have hardwood floor in this studio. Like, I need a big girl studio now. I'm creating Grammys here, people. Come on, Grammy winning albums. I need to have hardwood floors. And I couldn't find a company. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to try to install. I had all the materials. I'll have the floors. I was like, I'm going to try to install this myself. He's like, so this is an adventure. We do not know how this is going to go. And I was like, that is, you know, sometimes the biggest adventures are the ones where you're just kind of taking a risk, trusting yourself, and hoping for the best. Of course, there's no life or death with my floors. It would have just been a lot of money if I had to redo it. They came out great, by the way. I'm very proud. I'm like actually very proud of myself.
I'd be proud.
So when I think about, you know, traveling, like, yeah, sometimes adventures are, you just don't know how it's going to go. And it doesn't necessarily mean.
Yeah. And do you know what? I think that's something we've all learned from the pandemic. A lot of us have had to have staycations and stay in our own country. I mean, America, you could go on holiday in a different state. It's huge. But in England, it's pretty small. And, you know, staycation is not the dream. Anyway, during the pandemic, we've all had to do that. And we've all learned that actually you can go on an adventure 10 minutes down the road. It's your mindset, isn't it? As cliche as it all sounds. So, yeah, that very much makes sense. And with that, you can find an adventure in the everyday, which is great and very deep and wholesome. Yeah. Tell me about Hawaii then. What's this helicopter story?
So we went to Hawaii and we went to Kauai, and we both love Jurassic Park. So we're like, we obviously have to do the helicopter that goes over, you know, the big mountains with the waterfalls where Jurassic Park was filmed. And the morning we were supposed to get on the helicopter, it was pretty foggy. And my husband is like, listen, he said this to the helicopter company. He's like, I'm in a service industry too. I know that, and that's weather dependent, but like, you need to call it. Like, you can't, you probably can't fly now. And they're like, no, no, clear up, we'll be fine. So we go, and the second we go up, it's like the topsy-turvy helicopter, like not stable. And like the fact that it was like because the air pressure was all weird because of the fog. So it was like a bumpy ride, but you also couldn't see the horizon. So, you know, remember that time I told you that I like get nauseous really easily on when I travel on things. So I literally had my head between my legs and I was like crying, and my poor husband's like, and I was in the front and like Silas was in the back, and he like tapped me. He's like, there's the Jurassic Park. And I like looked out the window and I was like, great. I was like, mother, like, so we get down and somehow he convinced them to give us a half refund or whatever. Cause he was like, you should not have flown. You should not, it did not get better. It was awful. And I was like, I literally had to lie down the rest of the day because I was just so nauseous from just the lack of movement, the movement and the lack of being able to like get a point to look at, you know, on the horizon because of the fog. So it was completely a misery. But you know, we ended up walking the Nepali coast, which is in Kauai. It's fairly treacherous 3-day hike along just these mountainsides that go right into the ocean, and camped along the way. So we did this sort of rugged camping thing, and then we stayed in a really nice hotel for a couple nights and were able to have like kind of a full Hawaii experience from roughing it to that. And that was some of the most beautiful. I really love extremes, and it's one of the reasons I love Jackson Hole, because there's no foothills. You just see lakes and then boom, huge mountains. And I love Central Park in New York City because it's like this oasis, and then boom, you have all these huge buildings around you. So like that contrast for me is one of the things I love about travel, and where I can find that and see that. So this was totally that, these mountains that go right into this flat ocean. Both of them dangerous for their own reasons, both of them beautiful for their own reasons.
Oh, it sounds amazing. And it sounds like you regained some of the romance from wanting to home on the helicopter. So that's good.
Exactly.
Oh, that sounds really rough. And it's a small aircraft, which are the worst. I don't tend to suffer on planes, luckily. But not all was lost. It sounds like you had an incredible 3-day hike. I think I've heard of this hike before and seen pictures and videos of it, and it looks incredible. I mean, you can find waterfalls and all sorts, can't you, in the deep in the forest. And yeah, it sounds amazing. Hawaii's on the list, definitely. So what have you got coming up next then, Cheryl? Anything exciting in the pipeline?
This album release, I'm really excited about it. I'm curious to see how it does with the sales and the Billboard charts and all the things, and hopefully Grammy nomination at the end of the year. I am working with, like I said, I'm writing a piece for the Dallas String Quartet, and we're going to release that. And it's more of a classical piece with a little bit film score epic feeling. It's called Quantum Equivalence. So I'm excited about that. And I love working with them, especially now that we actually got to meet in person. So many collaborations during the pandemic were, you know, meeting over Zoom. And so that's kind of what's immediately next, that and finishing up the studio renovation.
Yes, you can tell your builders they can carry on now. We finished our conversation. They can.
Yeah. Amazing. Thank you. Yeah, I'm going to do a studio reveal for my fans, for everyone on my email list probably next week after I, you know, put the plants in and the lights and all the things.
Of course, you've got to have the plants in there.
Of course. Yeah.
Oh, well, it's been really great speaking to you, Cheryl. It's really interesting. I've certainly learned some stuff about the Grammys, about scuba diving, about music in general. It's been really, really interesting.
Thank you so much.